Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. Last week, we talked with writers Joe Bonomo and Rick Tellender about their favorite baseball writing. This week, we present an excerpt from a previously recorded conversation with author and historian Nicholas Bucola about his recent book, The Fire Is Upon Us, James Baldwin, William F. Buckley, and the Debate Over Race in America. To watch the full program, as well as view an accompanying photo slideshow, visit the American Writers Museum YouTube channel. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Well, I want to thank the American Writers Museum for hosting us. This is just an incredible experience. What a wonderful space. As we're thinking about two really important American writers, to be in this space is really inspiring. And to be here with Steve is just when Allison told me Steve would be here tonight, it was just, I kept pinching myself. I mean, this is such a wonderful opportunity to meet Steve, but also I was thinking about the work that Steve's done over the years, and thinking about that work through the lens that Baldwin provides. And Baldwin, I mean, I would say two of the most, you know, Baldwin described himself sometimes as a witness. He said, "My job is to write it all down." And Steve is really one of the great American witnesses. I mean, he has taken these photographs, and those photographs, I think, also capture something, a couple things that really mattered to Baldwin. Baldwin said that the role of the artist is to sort of capture humanity in all its complexity. And I think that you know, Baldwin, of course, did that beautifully with words, and Steve has done that so beautifully with photography. I mean, I don't think you can really capture the depth of humanity in this period. We just saw just a small example of what Steve's done over the years, and just capturing, as he said, just that image of those young folks, the dignity in their faces. We don't know the names of those folks, but the dignity in their faces, what a story that is. And the other thing that really mattered to Baldwin is that we come to grips with our history, right? That was one of his most important injunctives, you know, the things that he really wanted us to do. And I think in terms of coming to terms with our history, the work that Steve's done to chronicle that history, I think, is without parallel.
What about you?
I just want to say that. That's important for me to say that. That's the most important thing. So I think, I don't know, time-wise, I know, well, we're good. Okay. So, yeah, I'll just talk a little bit about the book and just give you a sense of what it is and a little bit of the story, and then we'll have time for folks who are able to stick around and talk with Steve and I, have Q&A, and Steve and I can talk a little bit. That's great. And then we're more than happy to sign books and in the back. But the book itself, The Fire Is Upon Us, is the hook for the book is this space right here. This is the Cambridge Union in England, on the campus of the University of Cambridge. And this space, 55 years ago next Tuesday, we'll be marking the 55th anniversary of the Baldwin-Buckley debate. This space, February 18th, 1965, was filled. It was so full you couldn't actually recognize the space. If you watch the BBC recording of what happened that night, the floors are almost completely covered. So all the spots on the benches are filled with students. All the spots in the galleries. The Cambridge Union is one of the world's oldest debating societies. And so this room is absolutely packed with people. And most of the people there that night were there to see James Baldwin, who was the poet prophet of the Civil Rights Revolution. And so the students were drawn by the idea of seeing Baldwin, in the flesh. But they were also intrigued by the fact that he would be sharing the platform with William F. Buckley Jr. And Buckley was not as well known at the time, but he was, the sort of rumor around campus was that he would be a worthy foe for Baldwin. And he was somebody who was a very skilled debater and had a radically different worldview. Buckley was understood to be one of the great critics of the Civil Rights Revolution. And so the Cambridge debate that happened February 18, 1965 it constitutes the climactic chapters in the Fire Is Upon Us. But as you can see, it's a pretty hefty tome. It's about more than what happened that night. Baldwin and Buckley were born about a year apart from each other. They're almost exact contemporaries. And so what I do in the book is I weave their intellectual biographies against the backdrop of the rise of the civil rights and conservative movements. And then get, so we start out with that night at Cambridge, and then we end up back there by the end of the book. And so what I wanted to do is take these two individuals who are so important to their respective movements, and they're so prolific in their writings, both their published writings and then the archival material I was able to access, the letters that they wrote, and this sort of private correspondence, that really I was able to get a little glimpse of what they were thinking each day, you know, as they were living through and shaping this history. And so that's what the story is. And I'm going to give you just like a really brief sense of what some of the story that I tell in the book, just to give you a little bit of a peek of what the book's about. So I start the book with Baldwin and Buckley in their younger years. Try to sort of go back to Baldwin's born in 1924. Buckley's born in 1925. They're born in the same city, but I say in the book they may as well have been born on different planets. Baldwin describes growing up in Harlem as the oldest of nine children. And one of the words that he uses to describe his childhood is claustrophobia. Baldwin said that often he would be sharing one bed with five or six of his siblings. And so they're living in, like a lot of folks in Harlem, in really difficult conditions. And Baldwin says that, you know, the sort of defining fact of my childhood is that my parents were struggling to feed us, to keep us alive. And so he says that is the most important fact about my childhood. And he watches his father, especially David Baldwin Sr., really consumed by despair. Baldwin says that his father, he dies in 1943, ends up dying in a mental institution. And from James Baldwin's perspective, his father really died of despair. He felt this desperation, this inability to feed his family. And really, Baldwin says he came to believe what the white world said about him, is one of the things that Baldwin concludes about his father. And so Baldwin is somebody who sets out in that context to find a way to escape that fate. And one of the ways he does that, really the way he does that, is through words, right? So here we are in this Museum of American Writers. Baldwin finds in language, he finds in books, first a way to make sense of the world, right? He's reading books all the time. He read every book at the local library, and then began to venture outside of Harlem to libraries where he wasn't supposed to go to read every single book he could get his hands on. And he was really taken by the power of books to connect people across time and space and helped him make sense of his own experience. And so Baldwin then begins to write. At age eight, he begins to write and writes and writes and writes until the day he dies. And so part of the story of Baldwin, the story I tell in the book about Baldwin's childhood, is the ways in which he tries to make sense of that experience in Harlem, and the ways in which it provides a foundation for everything that he would do for the rest of his life. Buckley is born in New York City as well. He's born in 1925, November 1925. And Buckley, you know, it's hard to imagine much different circumstances than the circumstances Baldwin described. So Baldwin describes that claustrophobia. Buckley describes seemingly endless space. So most of his childhood is spent at a place called Great Elm in Sharon, Connecticut, 47-acre estate, servants, all sorts of, you know, big mansion, servants, live-in tutors. Buckley describes the experience of growing up in this household. He's one of 10 children. They're, you know, tremendous affluence, tremendous privilege, and he just describes this seemingly endless possibilities, right? They are taught every subject under the sun right there in their own home with the live-in tutors and visiting tutors. They're out, you know, they're learning, you know, a part of the day, and they're out, you know, riding horses and things like that, you know, the rest of the day swimming. And so Buckley describes this experience of growing up in this tremendous affluence, and he describes the worldview he was taught along with that experience, right? And his parents taught him, and there's a lot of detail we could get into in the Q&A if you'd like, but he's taught by his parents that that there are some people in the world fit to rule, and there are others fit to be ruled. And guess what, Buckley children, you are fit to rule. And so one of the things his parents teach him is, in terms of his obligations, his obligation is to defend that worldview, Right? They say that worldview is what has made this worldview is what has made this tremendous affluence possible for us, and you need to go out there and defend it. So Buckley doesn't quite want to become his father, but he wants to defend the worldview his father taught him. And like Baldwin, this is one commonality with Baldwin. He is has a great skill with words, with language, and he goes out into the world and in a variety of different ways tries to use words to defend this worldview. And he will, from the very beginning, see people like Baldwin as threats to that worldview, and that's sort of. And so build up the tension as we work our way toward the debate itself. Buckley, just, you know, very quickly, Buckley went on, he left that childhood estate, one of his parents' many estates, and he ended up at Yale. And when he's at Yale, he takes it as his purpose to really criticize the American higher education, right? So he shows up at Yale and he says, I was taught by my parents to believe in Christianity and individualism, and I expected my professors at Yale to reinforce those beliefs, but I often found my professors were skeptical about Christianity and individualism, even hostile to Christianity and individualism. And so Buckley takes it to be his purpose to push back against that kind of establishment view. And he says, you know, he writes for the student newspaper, becomes the editor of the Yale Daily News. He's a debater at Yale as well. And what he tries to do is use language to defend this worldview, to defend that hierarchical worldview his parents had taught him. And he even goes on to graduate from Yale, and the first thing he does is write a book-length indictment of his alma mater, right? So he writes God and Man at Yale, in which he says that the idea of academic freedom is a hoax, needs to be overthrown. We need to break free of this paradox of parents, Christian individualist parents, sending their children off to college only to become atheistic socialists. And so Buckley calls for the overthrow of academic freedom and the imposition of what he calls an orthodoxy. And Buckley, this idea of orthodoxy is really crucial to understanding Buckley's worldview. He believes that any sane society is a society that's closed. There are some ideas that cannot be expressed. And so Buckley goes on to write the next book he writes after God and Man at Yale that attacks academic freedom. The next book, if that wasn't controversial enough, the next book is a defense of Joseph McCarthy. So he writes McCarthy and His Enemies, which is a defense of Joseph McCarthy. And Buckley says, look, McCarthy's not perfect. But he's enforcing a public orthodoxy that needs to be enforced. And so Buckley, he writes these two books, becomes a kind of figure on the national scene at a very young age, much like Baldwin, in that regard. But a lot of the people in the establishment, of course, don't like what he has to say, but he proves to be impossible to ignore. And so Buckley's out there defending this worldview while Baldwin's getting his start as a writer. In the late 40s and early 50s, these guys arrive on the intellectual scene at almost precisely the same moment. And Baldwin, for his part, he wants to write a novel. He wants to write a novel that captures his experience growing up in Harlem. And he does eventually succeed in doing that. It's called Go Tell on the Mountain. For those who haven't read it, definitely recommend that you do. Baldwin writes, he wants to be a great, you know, fiction writer, but he also is getting his start as a nonfiction writer. He's writing book reviews, he's writing essays. The nonfiction, really the key, I think, to understanding what Baldwin's up to is he's really obsessed with a kind of nexus of three things: identity, morality, and power. Baldwin is always really focused on what he calls the question of identity. Who is it that we take ourselves to be as individuals and as members of groups? Who do we take ourselves to be? And then the related question of how does our construction of identity lead us to treat other people? And he's very interested in the connection between those two things. And the background of those two things are these big questions of power. Who has power? Who doesn't? Why? And what can we do about it if that power distribution is not justified? And so Baldwin, really, what he concludes about human nature is that most of us, most of the time, are in a state of identity crisis, that we really don't want to come to terms with who we really are. So what we tend to do is create identities that make us feel safe. Right? And Baldwin thinks these identities are fundamentally often false identities. But they're identities that we construct using mythology, using ideology, in order to make ourselves feel safe, and often to make ourselves feel superior to others. So Baldwin says we are constantly relying on this idea of status, right? If we can frame our own identity in a way that makes us feel superior to someone else, then that will make us, but for a moment, feel safe. Now, Baldwin says the trouble with that is it's not going to work, right? We're always going to be in a state of status anxiety. We're always going to be haunted by the idea that someone somewhere is going to have reason to feel superior to us. And so Baldwin, basically what he says is this is the human conundrum. This is what we need. If you want to understand racism, you want to understand homophobia, xenophobia, any ideology of exclusion, at the core is that human paradox, right? That fear that we have. And so Baldwin, that's what he's up to in all the writings, the fiction, the nonfiction. He's grappling with those sorts of questions. So you have Buckley over here thinking about this idea of a public orthodoxy that needs to be enforced. And you have Baldwin over here thinking about these questions of identity. They're thinking about very different things, but you can kind of see why they might end up on a collision course. And indeed they are. Buckley's really the most important role that he plays in American political history is as one of my colleagues puts it, as the editor of American conservatism. So when Buckley's getting his start, there really is nothing we can call a coherent American conservative movement. Buckley is in that sense a founding father of the American conservative movement. And one of the ways he plays that role is as the editor of a magazine. So he writes those two books. They do quite well, but he's frustrated by the glacial pace of book publishing, and he wants to have an impact on day-to-day politics. And what he really wants is he wants a magazine of his own. He tries being a journalist, working for somebody else, but Buckley, remember, there's some people fit to rule, others fit to be ruled. Buckley was not cut out to be anyone's employee, so that lasts about 4 months. Most of us, if we want to have a magazine of our own, that's not something we can afford. Fortunately, Buckley had those very wealthy parents who gave him an advance on his inheritance. So he founds National Review, in the first issue appears in November 1955. And that what's important to note about that is that this magazine proves to be a kind of a way for the conservative movement to organize itself. And Buckley becomes kind of an intellectual bouncer. Who's going to be allowed in? Who's going to be allowed out? Who's going to be, you know, edited out of conservatism, and who's going to be part of it? And if you think about the timing, when he's launching the magazine, 1954 is when he's, you know, fundraising and putting together the editorial staff. 1955, this is right in the sort of moment when the latest phase in the civil rights movement is taking off, right? Brown versus Board, the school desegregation decision in 1954, the conservative backlash against that decision in the South, the rise of the White Citizens Councils and so on, the Southern Manifesto in Congress. You have the arrest of Rosa Parks, the Montgomery bus boycott, the lynching of Emmett Till. All of that is happening right in the same months when Buckley is founding National Review. And so Buckley, as the editor of this new conservative magazine, as the founder of American conservatism, has to decide what the magazine is going to have to say about race and civil rights. And what I always make sure to point out here is it's not a foregone conclusion that someone founding a conservative magazine in 1955 will be hostile to civil rights. There were conservative, right, the leading partisan faction resisting civil rights were Southern Democrats. Buckley thought of himself as a Republican. There were many people who thought of themselves as conservative Republicans who were actually quite favorable to civil rights, including William F. Noland, who was one of Buckley's political heroes, who actually wanted Noland to run on Eisenhower's right in 1956. He wanted him to primary Eisenhower. Noland was somebody who thought of himself as friendly to civil rights. But Buckley chooses a very different course, and that course is really what sets him on this collision course with Baldwin. Buckley, and this is something I get into a lot of detail in the book, and I won't get into it right now, but Buckley, from the word go, everything in the magazine, almost everything in the magazine, is hostile to civil rights. So the magazine makes very clear they're against the Brown v. Board school desegregation decision. They're against any federal intervention, whether it's by Congress or by the courts, in order to challenge segregation in the South. They end up being against the Civil Rights Act of 1964, against the Voting Rights Act of 1965, critics of the Freedom Riders, critics of the sit-in protesters, critics of Martin Luther King. One exception is they are okay with economic boycotts. They think that's a legitimate form of social protest. But other than that, they're critical at just about every turn. And they offer a lot of rationales for this. And I'll just give you the one that Buckley gives us in his perhaps his most infamous piece in 1957, Why the South Must Prevail. Buckley says that, and this is on my first slide, so I will quote him directly. Buckley says, as you can see here better than I can, and I will, the white community in the South is entitled to take such measures as are necessary to prevail politically and culturally because for the time being it is the advanced race. And so Buckley makes this explicitly, you know, white supremacist argument in defense of his position. And he says in that piece that essentially the obligation that supersedes all other obligations is the preservation of quote unquote civilization. And white people in the South, he argues, are more civilized. And so they have the right, not only the right, but the duty to exclude African Americans from voting and from other aspects of full citizenship. And Buckley takes that view, and in some ways, you know, he has all sorts of rationales for that view, but at the bottom of all of them is an assumption that some lives matter more than others, right? And that's one of the things I argue in the book, is that there is this kind of implicit, there's this explicit white supremacy you can see in comments like that, but there's kind of an implicit white supremacy in all sorts of other arguments that Buckley makes. And so Buckley, he defends that view in every way that he can, in writing, in speeches, in debates. And what I get into in the book is the ways in which Buckley and this crew that I have pictured up there, and that it goes from, you know, he cozies up to everybody from, you know, James Jackson Kilpatrick and Strom Thurmond, the leading, you know, leading segregationist figures, to William J. Simmons, who was the head of the White Citizens Council. Buckley is trying to figure out with all these folks how to resist black liberation. And so they're rationalizing this intransigence right at that very moment. Baldwin is making his first trip to the American South. So Baldwin lives, he calls himself a transatlantic commuter, but he lives in Paris most of the time from 1948 to 1957. 1957, he feels obliged to come back and really devote himself to the civil rights struggle in first as a journalist, right? He wants to play this role as a witness. And I think Steve got to see Baldwin at this moment where his sort of role as a witness and his role as a kind of activist are really in some ways both operating. But Baldwin, the first thing he does is he goes down to the South, and one of the really remarkable moments for me as a writer was going from this really deep dive into the Buckley and his world and how they were justifying their resistance to black liberation, going from that to Baldwin sitting in the living room of a 15-year-old boy who's one of the first African-American students in a previously all-white school in Charlotte, North Carolina. Baldwin describes sitting in this living room, looking this 15-year-old boy in the eyes and trying to understand what the world looks like through those eyes. So he says that this young man has had to confront white students forming a barricade at the front of the school when he's just trying to attend his classes. He's been subject to verbal and physical assaults on a regular basis in this new school. And Baldwin just wants to know how this young man manages to grapple with what Baldwin calls with surely the most difficult moment of his day, the morning when he wakes and realizes it all has to be gone through again. And so Baldwin wants to try to get a sense from this young man of what that's like. What does the world look like through those eyes? And then he wants to talk to the young man's mother, who's in the room, and she's one of only a few dozen African-American parents in a city with 50,000 African-American people who even applied for this integration program. So in some sense, she sent her son marching toward that white barricade. And Baldwin, as the oldest of nine siblings, often was, you know, fascinated by and haunted by, as Steve pointed out, what the world looks like through the eyes of a parent like this young man's mother. Baldwin was wondering how she had the audacity, how she had the courage to put her family in this situation. And so he talks to her for a while. And then Baldwin goes from there to sit down with the white principal of the school. And Baldwin goes into that meeting wanting to try to understand what the world looks like through his eyes. And he gets a sense pretty quickly that this guy is not a rabid segregationist. He's a relatively young principal. He's integration is against everything he's ever known. But Baldwin says he seems like a gentle human being. He seems like even an honorable human being. But Baldwin says he also is a delusional human being because he's unable really to see the humanity of this young man who's just trying to get an education. And so Baldwin says, you know, he wants to try to understand, though. This is part of capturing the complexity of human nature. He says, I want to try to understand how this principal is understanding his role in this drama that's unfolding. And how can understanding the way he views the world help us make the world a more humane place? So Baldwin and Buckley, and this is in the period that most of the photographs that Steve showed us, the book, as I get further on in history, the chapters cover, you know, smaller and smaller slices of time because so much is happening, you know, in 1962, 1963, 1964. And Baldwin and Buckley are really right at the center of this history. And so what I try to do is give the readers a sense of how they're living through and shaping this history. And there are so many examples that that I found especially powerful as I was writing, and I'll just give you two, and then I don't know if we'll be able to get. I could play a clip from the debate if the technology will cooperate, and then we can have a conversation. But just to give you a sense of a couple of these moments in this period when Buckley and Baldwin are kind of in the eye of the storm, as I say here. On the Baldwin side, there's a moment in late 1962. So, going back to one of Steve's photographs of Baldwin standing with James Meredith, right when Steve was traveling with Baldwin in early 63, James Meredith was an African American Air Force veteran who wanted to attend the University of Mississippi. And in late 62, he tries to register for classes at Ole Miss, and all hell breaks loose. You have what's known as the Battle at Ole Miss. You have an armed rebellion, an armed insurrection against against integration. And so, you know, people are killed. There's many people are injured. Many people are arrested. And Baldwin, just weeks after that happens, finds himself in a television studio in New York, sitting across the table from this guy right here, the upper left, James Jackson Kilpatrick. James Jackson Kilpatrick was rightly called by his biographer the leading salesman for segregation. Kilpatrick had devoted his professional life to doing all he could to defend segregation. He was on the lecture circuit. He was an editor of a newspaper in Virginia. He was in which he would write, you know, editorials basically every day of the week defending segregation. He was writing books defending segregation. So Baldwin is in this studio in New York in late 1962, sitting across the table from the leading salesman for segregation. And it's just one of these remarkable moments of Baldwin doing his thing. And Baldwin is sitting there, and he says to the first thing he says, they're welcome to the show. And this is something that hasn't been written very much about. Actually, Baldwin himself, his archive in Harlem, he kept a full transcript of this exchange, which was just like one of those moments when I was doing the research that just was jaw-dropping. So Baldwin, they're welcome to the show. And Baldwin looks Kilpatrick in the eyes. And he says, you think there's a difference between men like you, who wear nice suits and write fancy books, and the people in the streets committing acts of racist violence. Baldwin says, there is no difference. In fact, I hold you, sir, to be far more responsible than the people in those streets. The people in those streets are operating under a delusion that they don't really understand. Everything they've been taught is that their value as human beings is attached to their whiteness. And you, sir, have been weaving those webs of delusion. He says to Kilpatrick, I accuse you not of betraying me, James Baldwin, or people who look like me, I accuse you of betraying them. You are depriving those people of meaningful lives. That's how he starts the conversation. And then from there, he just plays the role of cross-examining prosecutor with Kilpatrick and criticizes his white supremacist views. And one of the really remarkable moments at the end of the conversation is that Kilpatrick he describes himself, and I should say Kilpatrick was one of Buckley's go-to guys on race, right? He's like one of Buckley's favorite writers on race. And Baldwin says to Kilpatrick, you know, you call yourself a conservative, but what is it that you are trying to conserve? And, you know, Kilpatrick says, well, I'm trying to conserve Western civilization. White people are best positioned to conserve Western civilization. And Baldwin says, this is the second betrayal, right? I accuse you of betraying Western civilization. whatever is good in Western civilization, whether it's what's best in the Judeo-Christian tradition that you claim to care about, Mr. Kilpatrick, whatever is best in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, you are betraying those values. You are undermining those values. You are destroying those values. The people who are actually defending those values are those young people in the streets who are fighting for their freedom.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the American Writers Museum podcast. Next week, we'll talk with writers J. Michael Lennon and Maureen Corrigan about the writing and legacy of Norman Mailer. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.